Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Today is a bitter, bitter twist.
Ooh, a bitter twist. Yes. What are we talking about today?
Oh, well, we're going to talk about IPAs and hops.
Oh, yeah, we are. I just remembered. No, I didn't.
What are we talking about?
I don't know.
I knew.
I thought you knew. I stayed up last night doing research. Yeah, I know what we're talking about.
Well, you know, IPAs are definitely year-round consumable beverages, but moving into the celebratory season, we've got all the holidays coming up, probably gonna drink some more beer, so let's talk about one of the most popular styles of beer right now. So before we go into IPAs, which stands for India Pale Ale, and we'll get into where the India comes from in a minute, it's important to get a brief understanding of its predecessor, the pale ale. But before the PAs, yes,
production assistants.
No, not those. I mean, those have probably been around for longer, I don't know.
Anyway.
But before we get to pale ales, we need to talk about Coke.
Coke?
Yes.
Wait, you just...
not...
Are you doing a bit?
No, not Coca-Cola. And not...
Cocaine?
Not cocaine. No.
Coca.
No, not even that. What we're talking about is a fossil fuel. So, yeah, I wouldn't expect you to know this about it, know this unless, like, 17th century fossil fuels are your jam?
Not yet, but I'm getting more interested by the second.
Coke is just, it's a term that's refers to a derivative of coal. It's kind of similar to how like charcoal is made from wood.
Okay.
So it's this fossil fuel burns really hot and it doesn't produce smoke or soot like other burnables of the time did. So it was first popularized in 1642, largely because it did have that lack of soot and smoke. And it became a darling of the steel and iron industry in England. And brewers found use for it too. Traditionally, they would be using peat fires or wood to smoke their beer mash or dry it out, which would impart inevitably a smoky flavor and a brown color to the beer. With the advent of Coke, they could create a lighter color beer with less of a smoky taste to it.
Ooh.
So this beer was referred to as pale ale.
All right. The pieces are coming together.
Yes. So we first start hearing this term around the early 1700s. It kind of becomes popularly available in more like the mid 1700s, 1780s. It was also kind of referred to as bitter, because just typically, like, the flavor that stood out more was the bitter qualities. Hops were added to this beer at this time. Now, this is where we get into IPA. Or rather, what you've probably heard about where IPAs come from.
I've heard a little bit about the East India Trading Company.
That's an important part.
That's part of it, right?
That's part of it. What I was told when I was getting sort of, you know, off-the-cuff liquor education in various bars and restaurants, and what I think a lot of people kind of have pieced together in their head, is that, like, sometime during the 1700s, it was the beer that was being sent to the British merchants trading in the East India Company, which was a joint stock company formed to trade and eventually colonize the country surrounding the Indian Ocean. Now, that is true. The myth is that it was hopped to a greater degree to prevent the spoilage on the ocean voyage that vexed other beers. Also, its creation is commonly contributed to a man by the name of George Hodgson, who ran a brewery by the name of Bowes Brewery in London at the time. And his invention was of a superior quality to all other options at the time, and thus beloved by the East India Company.
Okay.
Now.
Playing favorites.
Yes. That has a varying scale of not quite right to totally wrong in that origin story.
Okay.
so let's get into it. Now, what we do know to be true is that hops started becoming popular in ever-increasing quantities in beer throughout the 1700s. It was common brewing knowledge that was like logged in like farmers' almanacs in like the 1760s that adding hops to a beer increased its shelf life.
Sorry. What?
Adding hops to a bear.
What just happened is that Taylor has written in her notes that you should add hops to a bear to increase the shelf life of the bear.
No, I mean, I don't want bears to die, but I don't want like an extra long lasting bear. And definitely not on my shelf.
Get those bears off your shelves. They're too right. big. They're too big for those shelves.
No bears on
shelves.
They
need more room.
Oh, no. No, all right. But yeah, so throughout the 1700s, we already were adding hops to beer. We knew that increased quantities would make the beer last longer. This was not something particularly original to Hodgson's beer because he didn't start producing his beer until 1793. That's when he started exporting his beer. So the knowledge of high hopped beers, what we would now call IPAs, predates Hodgson brewing.
All right. So it wasn't like that just fluke thing, we gotta figure this out, and it just happened in the time that it needed to happen. We already knew about it.
Nope.
Okay.
Yep. Also, throughout this time, porter was successfully making the trip abroad. It boasted similar levels of alcohol as the eventual IPAs of the time would feature as a preservative factor. So we didn't have a lack of beer that was capable of making the journey.
Because beer has alcohol in it.
Yeah.
That's the part, that's the main part that preserves it.
Well, and the porters had, you know, probably around like 6-7% alcohol at the time, which is about what our IPAs that we would very soon be sending overseas would have. So similar levels of alcohol. And there are reports of the porter arriving, you know, into the Indian ports in excellent condition.
Drinkable.
Yeah. Now, I will say though, George Hodgson was an important brewer to the company. His brewery was conveniently located near the docks in East London, used by the company, and thus became a go-to source for them to purchase from for overseas consumption. And one style in particular that was popular at this time and utilized lots of hops was called an October beer. Now, the October beer is important to this story. This beer was intended to be cellared for 2 years, and it was popular among the upper class. And it did happen to be one of the styles that Hodgson sent abroad.
Okay. All right. This is like bougie beer.
Yeah. But in its style, it's an IPA.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, as we think of it now, a heavily hopped pale ale. Now, it is also thought that the tumultuous sea voyage with varying temperatures and moisture levels and humidity caused this October beer made by Hodgson to mature and perfect in the time it took to arrive to the Indian ports.
Ooh.
So purely an accident, purely luck.
So that's the part that was like kind of like that seems to me like that could be the essence of the legend. Like that was the thing that was actually kind of an event that was different.
Yeah. Well, yes, just purely a happy accident where the beer showed up on the shores and it tasted really damn good. It tasted like this, you know, this October beer was supposed to sit in your cellar for 2 years. A cellar is a very controlled environment. Mm-hmm. And you'll find this in distilling too. Like when we talk about things like spirits that are made in like really temperature and moisture variant areas of the world, they mature and age a lot faster.
Okay.
Because something's sitting at like, you know, I don't know, like a nice 55 degrees in dry air for 4 years is going to be very stable. But when you have something where it's, you know, expanding, contracting, it's having like, it just progresses the maturation.
It's like a human that has more experiences in a shorter amount of time. They age a little better.
I guess so.
Or
yeah.
Just different.
Just faster. So we have this beer arriving. And like I said, it was already a style that was popular among the upper class. So even in the East India Company, it was very popular among the upper class, among the like the officers. Mm-hmm. But alongside of this, your everyman, your you know lower class, your infantry, they still preferred the porter.
Right.
So it wasn't like the whole company was drinking the IPA this style. It was just kind of popular among the people that had a voice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, and as far as the idea that he made the most superior beer, as we said, it was already a matter of convenience, but something else that factored into why so much beer from Bowes Brewery was being purchased is because Hodgson would extend really long credit lines to the East India Company.
Ooh,
like, right. He would just let them not pay him back and just, you know, like, it was easy to take beer from him without having to worry about immediate returns.
I might patron that business, yeah, for that reason.
Yeah, he had a kind of a leg up in the market because he just had, he put more on the line, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess you got to take some risks in this business. How'd that work out for him?
Well, you know, when it passed off to his son's hands, the company, things got a little rough. Basically, poor handling of contracts. He alienated a lot of purchasers. He got a little greedy. He wanted more money. Everything that, the reason they had been buying his beer, the son kind of ruined all that.
Oh, okay.
And so a lot of the people in charge of the exportation of beer kind of started seeking out other breweries to produce this style that had become popular. At that same time, this is now, we're kind of in the 1800s, there were a lot of breweries in this place called Burton, England, and they had kind of a heavy hand in the Russian marketplace until the Tsar passed a ruling that they couldn't sell, there would be no more importation of British beer.
Oh.
So they were looking for other markets to get into, and this was kind of another happy accident. So they brewed beer specifically to appeal to that taste palette established by Hodgson's beer, and they took over the India Company market. Now, another great myth around this time period is that there was this, you know, so the IPA style was exported. It was really enjoyed by people abroad, but the home marketplace didn't have a palate for it until this East India Company ship shipwrecked on the coast of Scotland, and it allowed the locals to taste the export product because they just had to unload the product. Oh, and all these people were like, wait, this is great. Why are we sending it away? We want that here. And that made it a craze in the marketplace. Now, there was a ship that did wreck in 1839. It was full of beer, and that beer was eventually auctioned off in like a Liverpool marketplace.
Okay.
But the kind of fancifulness of the story also wrong. This style of, as I think they referred to them, they weren't calling them IPAs yet. They were calling them like made in the style of the India East Company Pale Ale, or, you know.
That's
like,
a little long-winded.
Yeah. But these were on the market as early as 1822. So this predates this shipwreck. And also it really didn't catch on until after the 1840s. And that was really only because that's when we start having like the train system develop across England. And so you have these breweries are able to send their IPAs all around the country and, you know.
And into Europe. And, yeah. Okay. Cool.
So it's not until the 1940s that we start to understand this as shorthand as the India Pale Ale style. But it catches on and like already popular internationally, becomes popular domestically, and then also other countries start brewing this style as a style. Start seeing it pop up in America, in New Zealand, in Australia. So, of course, with lots of our history with alcohol, we have this really cool style that's popular. Now, in Europe and the rest of the world, it stayed popular. IPA stayed an important part of beer throughout history up until modern times. In America, things were a little different.
Because we had Prohibition.
The Prohibition and war.
And war. Oh, yes. Yeah. War. Lots of war.
Lots of war. So, of course, like everything else, Prohibition killed off a lot, pretty all but the biggest breweries that could option to produce other goods. And they were banked by two wars where the need for ethanol and grain drained the available resources for brewing. Now, on top of that, as men went off to war and the women were left behind, breweries decided to create beers that were more palatable to women. I realize
what the fuck does that mean?
This is where we get light pilsners. This is where we get the American style of Budweisers and Bud Lights. And so these kind of become the popular style.
It's like
of
a watered
beer.
Down thing that you have to serve really, really cold.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And it just stays that way. Like it just kind of stays popular until now. I was kind of surprised to see the roots of the craft beer movement. They really kind of are founded in the 70s.
Oh, because does that have anything to do with the kids of the 70s hating their square old man and not wanting to drink martinis. And
I mean, maybe, you know, like maybe. They just having like homebrew. I don't know, hippies. That sounds like something they would have done. Like,
well, let's make our own beer.
I mean, they were really into like drugs, so I don't know if they needed beer, but maybe both. Why not both?
Let's make our own LSD. Let's make some LSD and then some IPAs, and let's just have a big old letter party.
Oh yeah. But no, in the 1970s. Craft beer was starting to make a comeback, and this was really kind of exacerbated by the passing of a really important ruling in the U.S. court, which was H.R. 1337 in 1978. Mm-hmm. And that made legal the production of small quantities of wine and beer in your home.
Oh, so then it was legal to do the micro brewing.
Exactly.
Cool.
So this opened the door for like over the span of the next like 25, 30 years in America. We went from like 40 some breweries in the 70s to like almost 3,000, you know, like in the last decade.
Oh my God.
If not more. I mean, like the craft beer explosion has been going on for a while.
Yeah, we have craft beers coming out of our ears in America.
Yeah, craft beers coming out of our ears.
Craft beers coming out of our ears.
You had that funnier than I did.
I liked it. It's cute. Yeah.
And of course, now that leads to today, where the IPA has firmly entrenched itself as one of the most popular, if not the most popular, style of craft beer on the American market right now.
Cool.
So some modern day IPA bits of trivia. Like I said, it's super popular category, but it can be made with a myriad of hops, varying alcohol content, and a wide berth of palate. So like a lot of these categories, it can be a lot of things. Mm-hmm. As far as styles go, you might hear like East Coast versus West Coast. Wonder what that refers to.
I do wonder. Please help me out here.
Well, the big differentials is like East Coast style typically refers to one that balances or looks more to a balance between malt and hop, with a lot of reliance on European malts and a stronger malt character, whereas West Coast IPAs, probably due to the readily available hop fields like in the Pacific Northwest, it's a really great area for growing hops.
Cool.
They usually have a way more hop focused character. Those big hop kicks to the face.
We got to do something with all these hops.
You got to make it just a big old hoppy beer. Just a hop punch.
Hop punch.
Hop punch. Now, you've probably heard of double IPAs.
Yes, I have.
That is also kind of, it's a recent-ish term. There's a now defunct brewery, Blind Pig Brewery, that was in California. Supposedly in 1994, they say they're the first to patent the double IPA, which was an IPA that was brewed above 7.5%. Mm. Now, I would just make the conjecture that as we saw there were beers in the 1700s and 1800s that were already hitting 6.57%, there were probably IPAs all across the board.
Yeah.
But they were the first to kind of establish that term.
Right.
The
weird double IPA.
Yeah. And then the other eye is Imperial India Pale Ale. It's Imperial.
Ooh, hoity-toity.
But that style of super high ABV beer kind of became synonymous with California and especially San Diego. So that's kind of like, you know, sometimes double IPAs are referred to as the San Diego style. I don't know.
All right.
It's a bit more outdated now because everybody makes double IPAs. And then in more recent times, and I've seen these come into fashion, they were kind of first referred to as New England style IPAs. They're the ones that have like, they're usually less filtered. They kind of have a hazy look to them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like really juicy, like really fruity.
I like those.
They're my favorite style in the marketplace. And they kind of became popular like it's recent, like 2010s, these started proliferating in the market. And it's only really in 2018 that like they were sort of recognized as like an official style. No longer called the New England IPA. Now it's called like the Juicy IPA or the Hazy IPA because they don't have to be made in New England.
Right.
Now, of course, all of this is funny because once again, this is all America. Whereas the rest of the world has not, like, they've had them.
We've been doing this, guys. We've been doing it.
Yeah. Okay. You know, we definitely got really into it, really excited about it.
Right. But, we're in America, like, fuck yeah, America. We're making IPAs. Look at that. Like, fuck yeah.
it. Look at us doing ingenuity.
Europe's like, we have been doing this forever, for centuries.
I like your Europe voice.
Excuse me? We have been doing this since before you were itty bitty babies. You are a baby country, America. Your baby country.
Yeah, we are.
A country of babies.
A country of babies. This is true on many levels. This is true. But yeah, so, you know, there you go. Next time you have an IPA. I'm sorry that this is a less exciting, less concise history. It's kind of like this stuff would have happened. Some people just claimed it.
Right. Yeah, this is a little bit of like ruining history. Extra special, neat.
I guess so.
No, I guess we do it. I hope all I the
did.
Time.
We've
done it before.
You ruined Captain Morgan.
I would ruin him again. But you can still enjoy IPAs for sure.
Oh yeah, still got a great long history, and all the same things still happen. They just didn't happen in this wonderful, mm-hmm. concise, sort of mythical way.
Right. That's like the storybook version.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about IPAs, and we've talked about this particular figure before, I'm going to bring her back.
Bring her on back.
I'm going to talk once again, but less briefly, more in depth, about Hildegard von Bingen. Okay, so Hildegard von Bingen was a Benedictine abbess, which means, you know, you live at an abbey. She's a nun. Writer, composer, philosopher, mystic, considered by many as the founder of scientific natural history in Germany, and most everyone agrees she was a polymath, which is kind of like, you know, that term like Renaissance man or person, or I might use the word like polyhyphenate or multi-hyphenate. Like, it basically just means that you're real good and real accomplished at a lot of different things.
Okay. I was waiting for that description because you kept saying words that I don't know. Like, one of them would clarify another one.
Well, some Renaissance man is kind of like a...
Get that.
Yeah,
get
like that. Like a jack of all trades, but except for like, it's not
like... anamorph. I don't know what you're saying.
Right. No. Anamorph. She was an anamorph.
She was an anamorph?
She could turn into a...
Lizard?
Lizard.
I was just guessing.
Of all the things.
That was the first thing I thought.
I want to be clear. Hildegard von Bingen could not turn into a lizard, but she had other things to make up for that flaw.
All right. Okay.
So she was born around 1098, and I say around because we didn't have really great records around then, so, you know, like... So I found some things that said for sure 1098, and then some things that were like, well, we actually don't know. But anyway, she was born in Bockelheim on the Nahe, which is not too far from modern Frankfurt, to a German family of lower nobility. Hmm. So, like, you know, basically they were technically nobles, but they were probably not rich. You know, it's the 11th century, so we don't know a ton about the details. Don't worry about it. When she was 8, her family decided to dedicate her to the church, possibly because they knew about her visions, which she began having at age 3, but more likely because she was their 10th child, and they could not count on being able to feed her.
Wait, so dedicate to the church means just...
You just give her to the church.
Oh, that is an adequate child to have visions.
Yeah.
The one you can't feed.
Very convenient,
okay.
Right?
All right.
So also, there was this thing called a tithe, which meant that you give a tenth of what you own to the church, and sometimes they did it with kids.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you have 10 kids, one of them goes to the church?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Yep. She was educated by a nun named Jutta, who was likely a teenager at the time, maybe like 6 years Hildegard's senior, who was an anchoress at the Benedictine monastery there. And an anchoress is someone who chooses to live in a sealed enclosure in the monastery for life. It's like you sometimes it's very weird. Okay, so sometimes they actually like build walls around them. Like they're like go into this enclosure and they'll start laying bricks and like seal them in. And you have like a little window that you can pass like food and like empty your chamber pot through, but like you choose to live this like hermit lifestyle, but like surrounded by other people because you're it's within a monastery or something like that. You know, she chose it, so whatever.
Oh, wow.
Her life. So Jutta taught Hildegard Latin and was probably the one responsible for her musical education. And Jutta was the first person Hildegard confided her visions to. And although Hildegard wanted to keep it a secret, Jutta told a monk named Volmar, and Volmar became Hildegard's second confidant and her secretary. So he would write down her visions for her. And by most accounts, she was not amazing at writing or at Latin. And she was pretty self-conscious about it. But hey, you know what? She's got other things going for her. And she kept her visions a secret for a long time until she had one really intense vision at the age of 44. At which time the vision instructed her to write everything down exactly as it happened, and it also gave her revelations that allowed her to understand religious texts without translating them, which is probably going to come in handy for her because she's not so good at Latin. But yeah, she did have really, like, even though, like, her conjugation and her grammar for Latin wasn't great, she did have really complex thoughts that she dictated. She wanted approval from the Catholic Church for her visions, and she got them from Pope Eugene III, who not only encouraged her to keep writing, but also gave her the authority to speak in public and to write on theological matters, which is pretty
wow
intense, because this is like, this is the 12th century, and she's a religious person, but she's a woman.
Right.
So that's a big deal. She likely used her visions to have a voice in a patriarchal society. She's considered a proto-feminist and often lamented about living in a womanish time. Proto-feminism basically means she was a feminist for her time, but not today. Like, her ideas were kind of, like, she had some ideas that were pretty progressive for the time in terms of feminism, but we wouldn't consider them progressive today.
I did take steps.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's okay. You know, you go lay some bricks and then step on top of those steps and lay some more bricks, you know? So in at least one of her visions, she actually criticized the Catholic Church by describing a woman giving birth to a hideous monster at the end of times, the woman representing the Mother Church, and the monster representing corrupt, money-grubbing officials of the church. Yeah, I know, right?
That's a read.
Yeah, that is, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was pretty outspoken and was no stranger to controversy. I found some research that said that she, even though she did have, except, like, she lived with Jutta and was educated by her in the monastery for years and years, and Jutta actually had a huge following. That's why she built up the monastery to have, like, people would come from, or women would come from far and wide to study with them. So she was learned in a way, but she claimed to have no formal education, even though I would say for the time a religious education is pretty formal. But some people speculate that she claimed to not have formal education so that her visions would seem like more credible to men.
Okay.
Because if, like, she came up with this information and they, like, were like, oh shit, she's right, but how could she be right? She's so dumb.
She can't, like, know that the church is massively corrupt.
Right. Yeah. It's very complicated, but you know, she used it to her favor. She did what she had to do. So Jutta was the magistra of the abbey at the time. When she died, Hildegard was unanimously elected to replace her, but the abbot of the monastery wanted her to be prioress, which means that she would be working under him and he would be in charge of the monastery, where, like her mentor had educated all of these abbesses and built up this following. So Hildegard was like, okay, fine, as long as the women could branch off and have their own monastery in the nearby town Rupertsburg. And she was like, that was in my vision from God, thank you very much, that's what I want, that's my condition. He refused. And so in response, she went into a state of paralysis, which was determined to be a sign of God's anger. And when the abbot himself could not move her, he finally granted her request.
That is a convenient paralysis.
Yeah, you know, like apparently like the moment that he agreed, she like jumped up and was like, spry as a young person.
Like, hustle, Hildegard. Yeah, you get it.
She's doing great. She also wrote the first known morality play, and it was a musical.
Oh, I don't know. Those two things sound fun, but all right. Well,
all the parts were played by women.
Morality, okay.
All the parts were played by women, except for one role to be played by a man, which was the role of the devil, who could not speak and could only communicate in grunts and screams.
That reads okay.
Yeah, it's good. It's the only medieval manuscript to survive with both its text and music intact.
I want to know more about this play, but that's really a different podcast.
Yeah, you know, like it's great. It's cool. Beyond three books that she wrote that chronicled her visions, she also wrote 80 songs, founded two monasteries, wrote two medicinal books listing thousands of herbal remedies and discussing sexuality in surprisingly modern terms at times. She went on four speaking tours where she spoke to crowds of men and women, and she made up her own alphabet and language for the nuns to speak with each other.
A secret nun language?
Yeah.
Nun speak. Oh my gosh.
She's been called the patron saint of music, of arts, of culinary arts, of herbalists, of mature women, of creativity, and most recently, of hops or of beer. And that is because now we get to the, I'm sure you're wondering, if you haven't heard us talk about Hildegard before, why I've been giving you the biography of an abbess, but here's where I get to that point. She wrote a book around 1150 called Physica Sacra, which translates best as the natural world. She wrote in it a bit about hops, which happens to be the earliest surviving text that mentions hops in beer. In book one, chapter 61, De Hopho, or Concerning the Hop, she wrote, it is warm and dry and has a moderate moisture and is not useful in benefiting man, because it makes melancholy grow in man and makes the soul of man sad and weighs down his inner organs. But yet, as a result of its own bitterness, it keeps some putrefactions from drinks, to which it may be added so that they may last so much longer. Now, it wasn't weird to put herbs in beer. We knew you had to put some kind of bittering agent in it. This was like, again, this is 12th century, so like we're still kind of figuring out how to make the thing happen. We know that it can happen. We just like don't know any of the science behind it. We don't really know about science that much. So you could use yarrow or juniper or caraway or mugwort, something like that. And that beer was called gruet or groot. And it,
Groot.
I am Groot. I am beer. And that also, so Groot referred to that kind of beer, and it also referred to the blend of spices that they used, that they put in it. But they didn't really know about yeast. They just put bread in the beer, like bread that yeast had like found its way into. And, you know, it just like happened. They weren't sure why, but they put the bread in it. So this was the time when like beer was more like porridge.
Right.
And this beer was, you know, at the time we were drinking it because like drinking water wasn't really a thing. You couldn't really drink water. So it was very low alcohol content. Everybody drank it. It was just something that was like, it was important to drink as sustenance. So it's kind of like this beer porridge nasty shit. And it went bad. It did go bad. And at the time when she lived, many healers and physicians believed hops to be a cure for depression, or what they called at the time melancholy. But Hildegard advised the opposite, which is a big deal because not only was she going against the advice of her modern officials, but also, you know, she was a woman. And at the time, the knowledge of a woman wasn't really taken seriously, even considering the clout that she managed to get for her visions and all that. In the 12th century, they believed in Hippocrates' four humors of physiology, which is black bile, yellow bile, blood and phlegm. So, like, this is what everybody believes, so she's going with that. Hildegard said hops increased black bile, which would make a person more melancholy. Yeah. The four humors is bullshit. But, yeah. But she wasn't completely talking out of her ass. She may have been onto something. So, like, here's what we kind of know now. Hops makes you sleepy. This is a bit of homeopathy, but it has been suggested that hops can increase your levels of GABA, which is like gamma aminobutyric acid.
GABA.
GABA in the brain. It increases your levels of GABA.
Need some more GABA.
Right. You gotta get that GABA. So GABA is in your brain. And GABA quiets the neurons of the nervous system. So it could be good for anxiety or insomnia, but not depression.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you're depressed, then you don't want to just sleep all the time.
You don't want that GABA.
No, you want less GABA.
No GABA GABA.
No GABA. You put that GABA GABA back where it belongs. Okay. And there's also some research that suggests hops can lower your body temperature, which would also make you sleepy. Huh? Another thing we know about hops is that it kills off a lot of microorganisms that can be in beer, making it safer to drink. But it also doesn't kill yeasts. Yeast are a microorganism.
Right.
It should, if it was killing microorganisms, it should kill yeast, but it doesn't. It doesn't kill the yeast. So that way it doesn't interfere with fermentation. The yeast get to do their thing and they don't have to compete with other little microorganism guys for those nutrients because the hops kills them, which also makes it safer to drink. In the 12th century, we don't know what yeasts are. We can't see them moving around. We think that fermentation is like divine magic.
Right.
And we don't know why beer without hops makes you sick and why beer with hops lasts longer. But most people are drinking beer porridge with old bread in it. So the fact that Hildegard is writing about preventing putrefaction is pretty ahead of her time, I'd say.
I like that description, beer porridge with old bread in it.
I mean, that's what it is.
Judged.
No, it's not judged. It's just like, that's where we were in history. We were like, this is what everyone drinks. Even kids are drinking this mixture. Like, they weren't drinking beer to get drunk. They were drinking, it was like considered a health thing. It was like, this is what you need to survive. Like, which makes sense because I sometimes, you know, in desperate times, I'll say in some of my college days, if I was a little broke, then I might have a beer as part of a meal because it was
liquid bread.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, she didn't get everything exactly right. And really, this is the only reason why she's credited with being the patron saint of hops or patron saint of beer. And it's not like, you know, it's not an official thing. It's an unofficial title. Mm. And that's just because her writings about hops are the oldest surviving texts that refer to hops in that way at all. You know, she died at age 81, which was really incredible for that time. You know, like
a good long life.
Yeah, the life expectancy around then was like 30 to 40 years, and some speculate that her daily ration of well-hopped beer may have been what let her live so long.
So I will take that advice.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it couldn't hurt. I don't know.
Some beer every day. I don't know. I'm not
going to
promote
that. Very, if you're going to do that, it's got to be really hoppy.
I guess if you're going to drink beer every day, just make sure it's IPA. Okay.
All right.
Cool.
Yeah. But she was actually, she is a real saint. She was canonized in 2012 and named a doctor of the church by Pope Benedict XVI. And out of 35 saints that were named doctor of the church, she is only, she is one of four women to ever be named a doctor of the church. And okay, so this is a little ruining history a little bit. Catholics, please cover your ears. I do like to like, I like science, you know. So she sometimes described her visions as wavy lines or showers of light, and they were often accompanied by pain. And because she was also a fan of science, she actually is quoted as saying, "All science is a gift from God." I think she maybe wouldn't mind the suggestion by some that her visions could have been auras from migraines, which sometimes are connected to auditory hallucinations.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the more you know, I wonder, because she was so into science and the natural world and, like, discovering these mysteries, like, maybe she wouldn't be offended by that, or maybe she would because she thought she was talking to God, or maybe she was talking to God.
God was talking to her through a big old migraine.
Right.
Wow.
Could be. I mean, we also, like, you know, I will say, I said that just because, like, When I read that, I was like, well, actually, that kind of checks. Like, auditory hallucinations are associated with migraines. Migraines are, like, what she describes, what she is usually describing in her visions is a, like, seeing the light of God surrounding something. So, like, she's seeing, like, because you can see auras. Like, I have, I don't have migraines, but I have been, I guess, like, loosely I see auras sometimes. I actually went to a doctor one time and they were like, that's weird because you don't get migraines. My sister gets migraines, not Teresa. My other sister, Erin, has migraines. Auras, sometimes you see, like, really, it kind of looks like twinkles in your vision, which sometimes I get. I don't really get migraines. I've gotten some pretty bad headaches, but I would say I don't get migraines.
Oh,
but
okay. So not like magical auras of people's, like, personalities. No. Like halos.
Yes. There, okay. There is
a physical thing.
There's a medical description that is a symptom of migraines. It's called an aura.
Okay. All right. I was giving you that face because I'm like,
no.
You just said I like science. I see auras, and I'm like, no.
I don't see like people's auras. I wish. Oh my God, that would be so cool. No, I see. Sometimes I see auras in relation to what you would see if you had migraines, which are just like, they kind of look like, I don't know, when I was a kid, I thought they were like fairies or something.
No.
Because they just look like sparkles and they just kind of like, you'll see them in your vision. It's very, you can't, if you're listening, you can't see what I'm doing with my hands to describe what these auras look like. But anyway.
Okay.
yeah, people with migraines have auras, which looks like beams of light or showers of light sometimes. And migraines are also, you know, auditory hallucinations are sometimes a part of migraines. They're associated with it. Not always, not usually, but, you know, that is a possibility. And who's to say, because we know so little about auditory hallucinations, who's to say that it's not both? I mean, I'm kind of like, I feel like I walk the line between science and, like, there's so much that we don't know. It could be both. It could be both. Like, you're having a hallucination, but maybe it is from God. I don't know. I can't say because I don't know.
Okay.
Okay. Well, she also has a plant genus named after her. It's called Hildegardia.
Oh, Hildegardia.
And she has a planet named after her. Oh, it's planet 898.
That's not a great name.
Well, no. The name of it is Hildegard.
Oh, okay. It just has a number.
It has a number, okay. So you know which one is hers.
That one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool.
Yeah. I mean,
what an interesting lady.
Yeah. Kind of connected to hops.
Yeah.
Kind of. I stretched it there, didn't I?
Well, you know, here are two hop adjacent topics for you. Okay. Hildegard and IPAs.
Yep. There you go. There you go.
So go have some beer and some auditory hallucinations.
Oh my God, yes. Thanks everybody who donated to our Patreon. Thanks for all our new Patreon members. We love your support. We use those funds you send us to pay for the supplies we need to make some cool cocktails for you and update our equipment. If you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we'll put the link in our show notes. If you want to support us, we are asking our supporters on Patreon to send us a booze-related question that we will answer on the podcast sometimes. We also have some exclusive Patreon content on there. We've got some videos you can check out. Thank you to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show this week. I don't know who you are because we're recording this in advance, but thank you so much, and I'll thank you next week too. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and give us a review if you like. Don't forget to head over to our YouTube channel, and we will have a fun video up tomorrow that's going to be about IPAs.
I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz Dune.
And this has been Neat.